It wants to eat my members. Perhaps we could eat it. But first Leviathan knew it would have to kill the monster, and to do that it would have to avoid those painful tentacles. If Leviathan had not been weakened and starving, there would be no contest. Leviathan's speed and strength would have made short work of this gossamer creature, except for those pain-dealing tentacles. We must avoid them. Leviathan conceived a plan. It was part desperation, part cunning. It called for a sacrifice. Deliberately, Leviathan willed three more of its flagellar members to dissociate. Faithful, mindless, they peeled away from Leviathan's body and began propelling themselves down toward the warmer depths. The monster immediately dived after them, so fast that Leviathan realized his plan could not possibly work. But there was nothing else to do. He dived after the beast. The monster's two longer tentacles touched the first of the flagella, instantly paralyzing it. They passed the immobilized member to the shorter tentacles so quickly that their motion seemed a blur to Leviathan. The tentacles, in turn, relayed the inert flagellum to that snapping, hideous mouth. The other two flagella were instinctively fleeing, diving blindly toward the warmth of the lower levels of the sea. The monster pursued them single-mindedly, which gave Leviathan its opportunity. With its last reserves of strength, Leviathan dove after the beast and rammed into it. Waves of concussion rippled through the jelly-like body of the monster, its tentacle writhed in pain. Quickly, Leviathan fastened as many of its mouthparts as possible onto that broad, flat body. The monster's long tentacles snaked back and stung Leviathan again and again, searching blindly for the parts where the armored hide members had dissociated and the more vulnerable inner organs were exposed. Despite the pain that flared through it, Leviathan tore through the monster's body, its mouthparts crushing the beast's flimsy body. The monster's tentacles went limp at last, and Leviathan fed on its dead body. It tasted awful, but it was food. Feeling stronger despite the strangely acid sensation simmering through its digestive organs, Leviathan resumed its course around the great storm, heading for the deeper waters where, it hoped, it would find plentiful food and others of its own kind. Leviathan had a tale to portray to them.
Into the Sea. Karstad nodded as if satisfied, then cast a quick glance over his shoulder. Krebs still appeared to be sleeping, floating in an almost fetal position up by the overhead. Grant dared not ask the question, but Karlstad grinned at him and made a circle of his thumb and forefinger. He's gotten into the station's medical files, Grant understood. Despite his better judgment, he wondered what Krebs' file said about her. With a blink of his eyes, Grant returned his attention to the sensors. He concentrated his attention on the ship's sensors. The generator and thrusters were performing so close to their design optima that Grant could almost forget about them, relegate them to a corner of his mind, a background hum of power buzzing along his nervous system. The sensors were something else, though. He could see through the murky alien atmosphere as if it were a cloudy, hazy day on Earth. Off in the distance, Grant saw a swirling snowstorm, a blizzard of white particles falling thickly into the sea. They're not really white, he reminded himself. You're seeing them in false color. Actually, they're dark, sooty with carbon compounds. The mana that makes Dr. Wo think there must be living creatures in the sea feeding off this bountiful abundance of organic particles. Woe's reasoning is more wishful thinking than logic, Grant told himself. Just because there are organic particles raining, or rather snowing, into the ocean doesn't mean there has to be creatures in the sea to eat them. That's a classic fallacy. They were getting closer to the blizzard. Hardly thinking consciously about it, Grant imaged the ship's planned course as a slim bright yellow line against the view of the blizzard. We'll pass by it, miss it by more than 400 kilometers. He felt glad of that. He had no desire to ride through another storm. Yet, at a deeper level, he felt disappointment and curiosity. Why are the particles concentrated so thickly there, and not any of them falling anywhere else in sight? If the organics form in the clouds, why isn't there a steady drizzle of them everywhere? It must be that they only form in special places up in the clouds. The processes that create the organics aren't spread evenly throughout the entire cloud deck. I'll have to ask Egon about that. If there are creatures in the ocean that eat these organics, we're most likely to find them under the storms that produce their food. The pressure outside was rising steadily as the atmosphere thickened into liquid. Grant could feel long, billowing surges of waves now, ripples and cross-currents racing through the ammonia-laced water. Riding through this ocean won't be easy, he realized. There's a tremendous amount of power in these waves. By the time Lane and Zeb returned to the bridge, Krebs was fully awake and snapping commands. Sonar pings were bouncing back to the receivers, reflecting off layers of true liquid now. Grant handed over the sensors to Muzarawa reluctantly. Zeb's going to be connected to them when we actually get into the ocean, he told himself, feeling jealous. O'Hara started to call out altitude numbers. 10,000 meters to the reflecting layer. Sink rate nominal. Be quiet, Krebs said. I can see the data perfectly well. She sounded testier than usual to Grant. She's just as clanked up about entering the ocean as I am, Grant thought. Thrusters to 1/3 power, Krebs ordered. Grant cut back thruster power. He had to look up at the main screen to see outside now. There were waves out there, restless, ceaseless swells, almost close enough to touch. They were reaching for the ship, heaving angrily, surging higher and higher. Grant wormed his feet deeper into the floor loops and grasped the hand grips on the front of his console. Glancing over his shoulder, he saw that Krebs was holding onto a hand grip set into the overhead with one hand, dangling like a thick-set monkey. Lower they sank, deeper into those long, powerful swells. Grant could hear his pulse thudding in his ears. Muzarawa looked tense, his hands squeezing on the console grips, making the muscles in his forearms ripple. Grant turned toward O'Hara, but Krebs shouted, "Left 5 degrees!" Looking up at the wall screen, Grant saw a raging current surging straight for them, blood red in the sonar system's false color imagery filling the screen. "Full power on the thrusters," Krebs snapped. Impact! The ship slammed into the current as if hitting a mountainside. One of Grant's floor loops tore free, and for a moment he lost contact with the thrusters. He stared down at his console, but the ship was shaking so badly the screens were little more than a blur. Then he felt the thrusters again, surging powerfully, singing their mighty song. Grant smiled inwardly as the thrusters drove the ship below the current's powerful stream, down deep beneath its shearing force. The shaking eased. The turbulence dwindled away. They were truly in the ocean now, safely beneath the turbulence, down where the currents flowed swiftly and smoothly most of the time. "Thrusters to half power," Krebs said, almost gently. "We're in the ocean," said Karlstad, almost as if he couldn't believe it. "Obvious, but true," O'Hara replied. "Stop the chatter," Krebs growled. "Check all systems." Grant found that the generator was performing perfectly well, and so were the thrusters. The only damage he could find was the foot restraint that had torn loose. "The forward infrared camera is not functioning," Muzarawa reported. "It must have been damaged on impact." "Repair or replace," Krebs said flatly. Muzarawa nodded. "I'm running a diagnostic now, Captain. If the damage is too severe to be repaired, I'll go to the backup." O'Hara reported no major problems with the ship's maneuvering systems, although one of the steering vanes had unfolded only part way. The ship had 6 steering vanes and 2 backups. Krebs ordered O'Hara to deploy one of the backups and fold the stubborn vane back into the hull. "Life support?" Krebs asked. Karlstad said loftily, "All my systems are functioning nominally, Captain. No problems." Before Krebs could comment on that, Lane said worriedly, "Captain, I can't get the vane back. It's stuck in the half-open position." Krebs scowled at her.